Welcome to The Environment Show, exploring issues and events of the planet. I'm Thomas Lally. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by the W. Walton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation for coverage of fisheries issues, the Turner Foundation, the Furthermore Division of the Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. Your host is Peter Burley.
Thanks, Thomas. Coming up on this week's Environment Show. Is traffic congestion getting to you? Is the Department of Transportation going to destroy your community by building big roads and speeding traffic? A citizens group in Virginia challenges the experts. The waters off the world-famous Florida Keys are in bad shape. Federal and state officials say a sanctuary is needed, but residents say it will only help the bureaucrats. We visit old-growth trees in Kentucky. And in our Earth calendar, penguins turn beaches pink and human noses red. These stories and more coming up on this week's Environment Show. The Piedmont area in Virginia lies between the outskirts of Washington, D.C. and the eastern slopes of the Blue Ridge Mountains. Four of our first five presidents lived there. A highway runs through the Piedmont, known as Route 50. It started out as an Indian trail, and parts of the road were laid out in the 1760s by a young surveyor whose name was George Washington. Three communities are linked by Route 50, Aldie, Middleburg, and Upperville. Punctuated with historic structures, they're self-sustaining, and agriculture is still the leading industry. With the development of Dulles Airport and more commuters going into Washington, Virginia transportation officials have at various times proposed widening of Route 50 and building bypasses around the towns at the cost of about $100 million each. Local citizens and environmental groups, opposed to the idea of their communities becoming simply appendages to superhighways, formed the Route 50 Corridor Coalition, which has proposed a radical alternative to the road straightening bypass construction called for by the Transportation Planning Department. It's a concept called traffic calming, pioneered in Denmark 20 years ago and used extensively in Europe, but to date virtually unknown in the United States. The Route 50 Corridor Coalition hired Ian Lockwood, a Canadian transportation expert who is now transportation planner for West Palm Beach. He guided their process and introduced them to traffic calming.
Traffic calming are policies and measures that reduce the negative effects of motor vehicle use on little towns, communities, and neighborhoods, mostly by physically changing the design of the street. You change the design of the street by putting humps and curves and putting in street trees, maybe mini traffic circles, all along the street, periodically spaced, and then at each end of the street or neighborhood, if you're calming the whole neighborhood, you'd put entranceway features to let drivers know that they're entering a traffic-calmed area.
Lockwood says this is not the approach of conventional highway planners, who try to add more lanes and straighten roadways.
Oh, it's totally different, 180 degrees different. It tries to make the streets more community-oriented. It tries to be inclusive of all street users, just not motor vehicles. For example, it tries to be inclusive for vulnerable users of the streets, like pedestrians and bicycles, and take into account what's on the sides of the streets, like the homes and businesses, the institutions, schools especially, and parks and this sort of thing. It actually tries to make the streets cater more to the community as opposed to just the through traffic.
Lockwood traces the development process that traffic calming can affect.
The problem is that a town will grow along a highway or along a road. The traffic functions of the road interfere with the town functions, the shopping, the kids going to school, and so forth. And as the traffic grows, and as the town grows, the conflict between these functions increases. Now, the traffic calmed alternative is an interesting one because there are probably thousands of rural towns across the USA that are in the same boat as these three little towns along Route 50. And there is the potential to save millions and billions of dollars in bypasses by traffic calming. And what it does is it there's an entranceway at each end of the town telling the driver it's time to slow down. Then the road is redesigned to cause drivers to drive slowly through the town, but steadily through the town. And the consequence is that the businesses in towns don't suffer as they might have with a bypass. Safety is improved a lot. It reduces the tendency to sprawl, like bypasses tend to bring along sort of highway-oriented development. And it's really inexpensive. It's a fraction of the cost of the sort of the highway bypass alternative.
Susan Van Wagener is the chair of the steering committee of the Route 50 Corridor Coalition. She said when the bypass proposals were being made, the community was convinced there had to be a better way. They organized, studied, and searched, and found Ian Lockwood, who brought the concept of traffic calming. I asked her what advice she had for other communities.
My general advice would be to always get educated. Always look at alternatives, always learn something new. The standard practices that have been used for the last 50 years are not necessarily going to work for us for the next 50. And look at what people really do want for their communities. Transportation has become a very funny issue. It's come to mean moving cars and trucks as fast as possible from one place to another. And transportation is really about moving people. And I think policymakers need to look at that and what it has to do with people in cars and people in trucks, but also people on foot and in bicycles and in wheelchairs. And we have to take all of those things into consideration. What we have to do is convince the Department of Transportation to do something they've never done before.
Art Smith is principal transportation planner for Loudoun County in Virginia, where part of Route 50 is located. I observed that traffic calming does not seem to be an idea that came from the formal state and federal transportation planning community.
I think you're right there.
So the question is, why does it take a citizen group that has to raise its own money to come up with a transportation plan that could save hundreds of millions of dollars and save the historic towns and landscapes of the Route 50 corridor?
That's a very good question. I guess a lot of planning is done through established procedures, formulas, methodologies, with professionals getting very comfortable with them. And sometimes to get really innovative thinking, it may take an enlightened citizen's effort such as this. And I think this effort's been quite successful.
One of the members of the Corridor 50 Coalition is the Piedmont Environmental Council. Its president is Christopher Miller. He confirms the need to look beyond the transportation departments for alternatives to road widening and bypasses.
Transportation infrastructure, transportation planning, transportation decisions are political decisions. And right now, the transportation decision-making process in Virginia, and I think it's probably true in many other states, is dominated by people who want to build new highways and convert the existing roads into bigger and straighter and wider highways, and they're not trained, nor are they particularly interested in seeing resources go to other alternatives.
The next step for the Route 50 Corridor Coalition is to raise the money to do the engineering studies that will be required to determine the exact cost of the traffic calming strategies and then convince the transportation departments. Traffic calming may cost 90% less than the conventional bypass proposals. In the process, the coalition has turned an idea loose that could save some of American towns from being divided and surrounded with multiple lanes of asphalt. It's called traffic calming. I'm Peter Burley. Are you excited about an environmental issue? Join the Environment Show on the air. Just dial us toll-free at 1-888-888-8888. 1-800-849-GREEN and speak to one of our producers. You can reach us by email at envshow@aol.com, or you can visit us anytime on the Internet where you can hear The Environment Show and also give us your views. It's at www.enn.com/envshow. By the end of this month, officials in Florida will have decided the fate of a plan which aims to save the Florida Keys. The Florida Keys National Marine Sanctuary would establish rules for management of an area that has seen a sharp decline in biodiversity and water quality. Opponents say it will restrict their freedoms and their ability to make money. Others say it's the Keys' last chance. Environment Show producer Thomas Lally has this report.
The Florida Keys are the American tropics. There's nothing like them anywhere else in the continental U.S., and millions of tourists flock there every year because of it. But that has caused major problems for the area's fragile ecosystem.
The two mega threats that we view as being particularly important to the Florida Keys system, as well as to coral reef systems around the world, are water quality, diminished water quality, and number two, extraction of living marine resources, including fishing and harvesting, etc.
Jack Sobel is the director of ecosystem protection at the Center for Marine Conservation. The Keys started showing signs of stress years ago, prompting Congress in 1990 to pass legislation for the Florida Keys National Marine Sanctuary, which would establish federal and state control over nearly all the waters around the Keys. David Holtz, also with the Center for Marine Conservation, explains how the sanctuary would work.
The twin pillars of the sanctuary plan are the Water Quality Protection Program and a suite of marine zones that would set aside areas along the most heavily impacted reefs for protection, and a ecological reserve of 9 square nautical miles to protect biodiversity. In addition, there's, for the first time, prohibitions on damaging coral and seagrasses.
A final decision on the sanctuary will come on January 28th. John Ogden is the director of the Florida Institute of Oceanography and a professor of biology at the University of South Florida. He says officials have spent 6 years fine-tuning this sanctuary proposal.
From 1991 until today, actually this month, the process should culminate, there has been a six-year planning process which has involved state, local, and federal government agencies, a wide variety of citizens, hundreds and hundreds of meetings, thousands of written public comments on a draft management plan.
But not everyone is happy with the proposed sanctuary. A majority of Keys residents voted against it in a non-binding referendum last November. David Paul Horan is an attorney in Key West and a member of the Chamber of Commerce, whose 700 businesses voted unanimously to oppose the sanctuary. He says the biggest problem is with the restrictions on water activities like boating and diving and fishing. He fears that, for instance, people would be subject to user fees and regulations for just boating off their own piers.
Part of the sanctuary is a water quality program. We don't disagree with that at all. We think that should go forward, and it ought to be funded very, very well. But as far as the 2,800 square miles, we want that restricted to the reef track because all the rest of them are under federal programs and they're already funded. If they put them under sanctuary, they're going to do it with user fees, and that means a basic unfunded mandate or a tax on everybody that visits the Keys and everybody that lives here.
But backers of the sanctuary say they are trying to avoid undue burdens on businesses and residents. Professor John Ogden says business should improve in the long run if the sanctuary goes through.
The general hope is that these restrictions will in the long run have a beneficial effect on business in Monroe County. It's been shown time and time again that when you create an area, an undisturbed area for the general public to visit, and this is a big country and a lot of people want to have the ability of going out and visiting undisturbed areas. They do this on land in our national parks. They want to do it in the water. And when this happens, they will come. If you build it, they will come. And in fact, that seems to be the lesson from other developments like this. So I think in the long run, there'll be a beneficial effect on business, on tourism, particularly in South Florida.
Still, opponents are skeptical. Key residents are famous for their disdain of authority. The Keys are known as the Conch Republic, and residents take pride in the area's history of pirates, rum runners, and exiled artists. David Horan says the proposed sanctuary will be out of local control and placed in the hands of federal and state bureaucrats.
I think one of the major problems with the sanctuary is this. Theoretically, in this country, law is a restriction on previously unrestricted rights, and the only people we give that right to are our legislative leaders. We vote for them, and by our vote, we give them the right to restrict our rights. If that unbridled discretion is given to a bureaucrat that is beyond your vote, heck, you can't even fire them. They've got civil service status.
Horan charges that the sanctuary is just an excuse for scientists and bureaucrats to keep their jobs, and that the real problem is to the north of the Keys in the Everglades. There, a mix of water pollution and outdated engineering projects have brought the Everglades to near collapse. A massive 25-year effort has just gotten underway to address these problems. But scientists say the sanctuary in the Keys is needed on top of the Everglades restoration project. Jack Sobel is the director of the Ecosystem Protection Project at the Center for Marine Conservation. He says without the sanctuary, the Keys may reach a point of no return.
Some predictions have estimated the decline of corals in the Florida Keys and in other systems at a rate of as high as 5 to 10% per year. Those may be overly pessimistic attitudes, but I think that the coral reef science community is saying in a very real way that in 10 or 20 years, if current trends continue, many of our coral reef systems will be lost in an irretrievable way.
Those close to the proceedings say officials in Florida are likely to approve the sanctuary. Skeptical residents of the Keys say it will just take power away from them and give it to greedy scientists and bureaucrats. But both sides agree that something needs to be done. The battle is over who gets to do it. For the Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
We all have places which are special to us. Some places are found in the heart of crowded cities. Others are deep in the wilderness. Mary Bird Davis is author of the book Eastern Old Growth Forests, Prospects for Rediscovery and Recovery. For her, these woods are special places where ancient trees tower above a diverse family of plants and animals. She says they were once so plentiful, few people thought they'd ever become rare. But today, only a few patches remain in the eastern United States.
When I told my elderly Kentucky neighbor that I write about old growth, I carefully explained that my subject is forests that have never been logged. To my amazement, she replied brightly, "You mean virgin forests with dead trees on the ground. There were lots in the mountains when I was young. I walked through one to get to the store. We went to the forest for mushrooms. Dry land fish, we called them, and my mother got dirt there, rotten wood dirt. She put it over seeds to make them grow. Well, as my grandson would put it, that was then, and this is now. I treasure a 100-acre patch of old growth bordering a U.S. highway, and I feel fortunate that it's only 60 miles from my home. Last June, a forestry professor introduced me to the site. As we hiked through it, greenery met our eyes at every level, from the ground to the canopies of the tallest trees, some 150 to 200 feet in the air. The growth was spaced in intricate patterns that unfolded as we walked, for the 100 acres are a classic illustration of old growth characteristics. Living trees of various ages, dead trees standing and fallen, gaps opened up by the fall of trees, uneven ground, also a result of tree falls, undisturbed ground cover. The site represents mixed mesophytic forest, the oldest and most complex association of trees in eastern North America. The indicators are white basswood and sweet buckeye, but many deciduous species, including maples, tulip tree, ash, and beech may share dominance. On the forest floor, herbaceous plants grow in abundance. Among them are maidenhair fern, the creeping Allegheny spurge, and mayflower, its flat umbrella of leaves hiding in June a single ripening green fruit. The low shrub layer is predominantly pawpaw and spice bush, with some magnolia, the huge leaves fanning gently in a breeze. The older trees display intriguing cavities. The lower trunk of an enormous living beech is little more than a hollow shell. Another living beech has 10 cavities up the trunk. Flying squirrels are its most frequent inhabitants. Much of the forest animal life is invisible, particularly at midday, although in June we could see bright yellow butterflies drifting through the canopies of the trees as they sought nectar. A square meter of the rich, black soil is home to an average of 75 earthworms. Patches of churned-up soil and leaves showed that wild turkey had been scrabbling for food. We caught sight of peewees hunting for insects high on a dead hickory, but heard without seeing a red-eyed vireo. A trip to the site is a bittersweet experience. We cannot stay in paradise. The forest is too far away for frequent visits, and more accessible woods pale in comparison. In my mind and spirit, I hold images of the forest. I hope that it will, in a literal and figurative sense, provide seeds of recovery. Perhaps my great-great-great-great-grandchildren will walk through an expansive forest that, though once logged, is taking on the richness and beauty of old growth.
Mary Bird Davis is the author of Eastern Old Growth Forests, Prospects for Rediscovery and Recovery, published by Island Press. And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. You may be suffering the biting cold which has clobbered the Midwest, but our neighbors to the south are enjoying the height of summer. Even in Antarctica, temperatures have risen to a balmy 30 degrees. Ron Naveen is the head of the Oceanides Foundation, which is doing groundbreaking work in Antarctica, studying fragile plant and animal colonies. He's in between trips there and says this is a busy time for all the animals, but especially penguins, which are scrambling to raise their young before the cold weather comes back.
This is the height of it now in Antarctica. It's the peak, the culmination of this bird's year. It really only has a short window of a few months to get back to this piece of real estate, find its mate, copulate, lay the eggs, incubate the eggs, raise the chicks, and then in another month, month and a half, it's going to start closing down in Antarctica, in the peninsula. It'll start getting very, very cold. The days will get noticeably shorter. And it's then time for the birds to leave, especially the adelies and the chinstraps.
Within a couple of weeks, the chicks will be almost 2 months old and ready to head to sea for the first time. They'll not return to land for 3 years. Some studies have shown that fewer than 10% make it back to land to breed, succumbing to a host of predators and other dangers. As a species, penguins are doing fairly well, but they may be affected by accelerating human activity in Antarctica. Naveen says penguins need to be protected because they have important things to teach us about ourselves.
And these penguins, we really need them. Understanding better what they eat and how they connect with other parts of the ecosystem there actually teach us humans a lot about how we should be treating the planet. There's a thin ozone layer, for example. Excess radiation coming through that thinned layer is probably, although studies are still going on, having some negative effect on the phytoplankton and the zooplankton, the krill eat. In turn, of course, krill is the major food item for whales, for penguins. So we humans are really only a few degrees of separation removed from the penguins.
The penguins, as well as many other animals, rely on krill, which are tiny shrimp-like animals. Krill sustains huge colonies of penguins, which set up shop on beaches and cliffs. Naveen says that he can tell where he is in Antarctica even with his eyes closed.
You quite literally can smell some of these colonies 7 or 8 miles away. Why? Because potentially at each nest you have two adults and two chicks just devouring whatever food they can get. The parents, of course, regurgitating this food into the mouths and the bellies of the chicks. And this guano, and in the case of krill, it comes out pink. So you have hillsides stained with pink all over the place in the case of Adelies and Chinstraps. And again, if the wind's blowing the right way, you'll know you're in Antarctica and near a penguin colony.
If you vacation on the beach in the Antarctic summer, bring your tuxedo to be appropriately dressed to meet the penguins. But don't forget your handkerchief because you'll have to hold your nose. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, in our interactive Talking Green segment, homeowners abandon their lawnmowers and hedge trimmers to take up natural landscaping. A new Tallgrass Prairie National Park comes to life in the Great Plains. The bounty of the almond tree symbolizes one woman's sacrifice in a myth from Morocco. And Marvin Gaye laments harm to the environment while grooving to the top of the charts. These stories still ahead on The Environment Show. This is Talking Green and The Environment Show, and I'm your host, Peter Burley. Today, we're talking about natural landscaping and the effect your lawn and garden is having on the environment. We want to hear from you. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. And our email address is envshow@aol.com. Planting lawns in arid climates leads to watering with water that may be in short supply. Many communities find pesticide contamination from lawn runoff is a major environmental threat. If we all plant roses from the catalog in gardens from coast to coast, we may be passing up plants native to our own area that grow better and provide more diversity. The alternative is natural landscaping, and that focuses on natural plants. Natural landscapers challenge that icon of American suburban culture, the lawn, arguing that in some places, native prairie makes more sense. Easier said than done. Natural landscapers have had to take some cities to court, challenging local weed laws that forbid substituting native prairie for closely clipped bluegrass. We have two guests with us today. One is Jack Barnett from the Air Quality Division of the Environmental Protection Agency in Chicago. And the other is Glenn Pollack, who is president of the Iowa Prairie Network, and he's joining us from Omaha, Nebraska. Glenn, I want to start with you. Folk have been planting lawns and planting roses and doing what they think is an environmentally great thing to do, and had a good time doing it. And your group is saying maybe that doesn't make any sense. What's this all about?
The native plants are adapted to the region here is why we encourage those. And, of course, our main situation is to protect the native habitat that is already in existence. But native plants fit the environment. They handle disease. They handle the drought. And typically you do not use fertilizer. You do not mow as often. And you do not use pesticides or herbicides. So we're saying that a native landscaping is easier to establish and less toxic on the environment.
Now, Jack Barnett from EPA, you're in the air quality business, and that seems like a far cry from lawns. Why does an official from the Environmental Protection Agency, worried about air quality, join us to talk about natural landscaping?
Well, much as Glenn said, you don't cut the native plants as often. Therefore, you reduce emissions from lawnmowers and tractors. You reduce the pesticide and fertilizer and lawn chemical side, so there's a savings there both for the land itself and the runoff to the waterways. And the longer the native plants typically have longer root systems, so they bind up more carbon in the soil, and there's less carbon in the atmosphere, and we reduce our greenhouse gases that way.
So let me ask you both. Suppose I live in a nice little house with a nice little lawn around it in a very dry part of the world, so I'm watering it all the time. How do I convert to natural landscaping? What should I expect, and what happens?
Let me start with that. The hardest thing to do is to determine what is native for your area, and you may have to go to your local nature center, your local county conservation board, Fish and Wildlife Service, or people determine just what is native to my area. And then the next situation is obviously check your weed laws. You may have to file for permits or variances. Talk to your neighbors. Explain to them what you're going to do. Then finding how these native plants grow is the next hard project. For example, there's a book called Prairie Propagation Handbook by the Ware Nature Center in near Milwaukee. Restoring a Tall Grass Prairie is another book that's available. So you need your handbooks, your permits, and then you need to find your seed or plant source.
And indeed, what may be a beautiful piece of prairie is a weed to somebody else. I'm going to go to the phones now. We've got a call from New York City. Mark, you're talking green. What's on your mind with respect to natural landscaping?
Well, I had one concern, or maybe two. I don't know if they're questions or concerns, but if you're going to, put native plants in your lawn, let's say, or my neighbor will, it seems like it would be a mass of weeds attracting unwanted pests, such as, I don't know, rats or maybe other vermin type animals.
Good question, and I presume if one starts doing native landscaping in your hometown, that really is a concern. So,
well, the outer boroughs people do have lawns.
Sure. So what about that? Jack, is that an issue? What do you think?
I think that the native vegetation does not provide food or shelter in any quantities to sustain vermin. There may be some native voles and mice and things like that that may be attracted, but the typical rats in the city type, Norway type rats, are not attracted to this type of landscape because it's very unnatural to them. And again, as I say, it doesn't provide the sort of food or shelter that they would need. So that doesn't seem to be a problem with most native plantings.
Glenn, what's been your experience in Iowa?
Very similar to that. There's been the argument about the vermin, and all the scientific studies that have been done have never shown a situation where any animals or insects harmful to humans have ever occurred in native plantings.
Well, Mark, thanks for your call. And Glenn, amount of care does the native landscape substitute for the lawn require? We all think of folk mowing the lawn every weekend when they'd rather be doing something else. If you tear up the lawn and put in a native landscape, how much work does that require, again, in your part of the world, in Iowa, Nebraska?
Well, the first 3 years are probably the most difficult because most urban landscapes, there are absolutely no natives, but you have tons of exotics. And, for example, my backyard, which is in natives, it took about 3 years for me to hand weed and remove all the non-natives out while the natives established. The natives established very slowly. Their emphasis is putting roots down, and the non-natives, the exotics, put vegetation up and very little roots. So your first 3 years really put a lot of work in. And then after that, only once a year do I mow my backyard, and basically that's to remove any kind of a fire hazard because obviously prairie really likes to burn, and it's part of its natural system, but you really wouldn't want that to happen in your backyard. So
I was going to ask you about that, because I'm sure that burning the backyard is not something the neighbors would appreciate. And, Jack, you might not like it either as an air official at EPA. What is the substitute for burning when one puts native prairie in the backyard rather than out on the unpopulated plains of Middle America?
I think Glenn can take this, because you mentioned that you cut it once a year, Glenn, right?
Yes, I merely cut it, and we have a fairly good lawn recycling program to cut it now, and I just merely cut it and bundle it up, and I do collect the seeds off it and use that for other projects, and gave it out to my friends and such, so it's always a good opportunity to produce more native seeds. But there are cities such as Des Moines, Iowa, where you can get a permit to burn your backyard. And you obviously have to leap through a bunch of hoops and provide safety, but some cities are understanding about this.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got a call from Chicago. Hello, you're talking Green on the Environment Show.
Yes, hello. This is Brett Rappaport.
Hi, Brett.
How are you doing?
Brett, my recollection is that you're a lawyer.
Yes, I'm an attorney in Chicago. I'm also the president of a group, Wildlands Natural Landscapers Limited.
And how does an attorney in Chicago get wound up in legal issues relating to natural landscaping?
Well, about 5 or 6 years ago now, I represented a group of Chicago citizens and homeowners, about six of them, who had natural landscapes and had been prosecuted by the city of Chicago every spring, pretty much as a rite of spring, for violating Chicago's local weed ordinance. And we took the case and filed a lawsuit contesting the constitutionality of that weed ordinance.
And doesn't it sound a little crazy that there would be laws that stop people from, again, returning the land back to what it was when it began? What's the basis of the original concept that forced you to go to court to let nature do its thing?
Well, there's really two versions of weed laws. One are the legitimate agricultural weed laws, which are in rural townships and apply to pest species of plants, which is everybody recognizes as legitimate and important. But the second kind, and the weed laws that are the bane of natural landscapers, are local city weed ordinances, which were originally designed to protect the citizens and the town against the negligent homeowners who would just let their yards become cluttered and overgrown. And those laws have been used mostly by uninformed village officials and neighbors to prosecute natural landscapers. They view a natural landscape as an unconventional, wild-looking yard, and therefore assume that it is a product of neglect, not of design.
So, you know, in a society when people are always saying bad things about lawyers, one thing you can say to them is that, but for you, people could not exercise their right not to cut the lawn.
Yeah, we took the case on, and as we say in the law, on a pro bono basis for free to litigate a position that we thought was very important. And I'd be glad to tell you that we were successful in convincing the city of Chicago that natural landscaping is a positive, not a negative, and that the city, particularly since in the last 3 or 4 years, has become a significant natural landscaping proponent. In fact, on LaSalle Street, outside my office window, there are center flower dividers in the street, which have all been planted with prairie grasses and coneflowers and other native Illinois plants.
Well, Brett, thanks for your call. Our time is short. I'd like, in wind-up, to ask any of you what you see as the prospects for natural landscaping. Will this have a real impact on what the face of America, at least in suburbia and places where people keep lawns and gardens, will look like over the next 50 years? Are things going to be different as a result of what you folks are up to?
Could I just jump in? This is Jack.
Sure.
There's about 20 million acres of lawns in the United States. I think lawns cover more American land than any single crop.
Wow.
It is the standard of beauty, if you will. And I think that we are changing that. And as an environmentalist, speaking of aesthetics, maybe I'm not as qualified as I should be, but I think that the aesthetic and the concept of what is attractive and what's beautiful is going to be changing. So I think there really is an opportunity, as the last caller mentioned, with the city of Chicago now being very progressive and looking at this as not only a cost savings and an environmental benefit, but also some very beautiful concepts as well. So I believe that there will be some changes.
Okay. Well, I'm afraid our time is up, and I want to thank you all. Our guests have been Glenn Pollack, who is president of the Iowa Prairie Network, and we have also heard from Jack Barnett, who is the head of the Air Quality Division of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency office in Chicago, talking about natural landscaping. This is Talking Green and the Environment Show. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. And our email address is envshow@aol.com. I'm your host, Peter Burley. Many natural landscapers have been driven by a desire to make sure that native prairie does not disappear from the American biome. So they're doing their best to create small bits of prairie in their backyards, on city lots, or in small farm fields. For almost three decades, one man has thought about tallgrass prairie in much grander terms. He is Ron Klataske, West Central Regional Vice President for the National Audubon Society. It was his dream to have a tallgrass prairie national park and preserve created, since there has been no prairie preserve in the national park system. In the closing days of the 104th Congress last fall, the effort that Klataske and hundreds of others he helped organize over the years came to fruition. Legislation was passed establishing the first and only tallgrass prairie park and preserve in the national park system.
The newly established Tallgrass Prairie National Preserve is in the central part of the Flint Hills of Kansas. It's a area of approximately 10,890 acres in size. It encompasses a rolling landscape that is principally covered with a variety of tallgrass prairie grasses and wildflowers. Throughout the landscape with bur oak and various other riparian forest trees along the streams.
Now, my recollection is that when you look out across those hills, you really don't see much in the way of trees, though. What you see is rolling green. Is that
right? It's a carpet of prairie landscape that in many vistas extends to the horizon. The trees are primarily found along the watercourses in the valleys, and when you're on the ridges looking across the landscape, you just get a feeling of vast, open space, a kind of a feeling that you can't get in many other landscapes.
Klataske says the preserve is about 15 miles from the route of the old Santa Fe Trail and can give the visitor a good impression of what the pioneers saw as they crossed the area in prairie schooners a century and a half ago. But he says the best way to see the prairie is through the eyes of the very young.
Yeah, I learn more from taking children out into the prairie than they can learn from me because of their expressions and delight of running across the landscape and looking at flowers and picking plants and picking up and looking at flint rocks and limestone rocks and looking for lizards and things of that nature. But I think that we all, to some considerable degree, experience a new our youth when we're in places like this that are awe-inspiring.
Creating the park was not easy. While mayors of nearby towns like Larry Bear of Strong City, population 600, and Ken Harder of Cottonwood Falls, population of less than 1,000, and the town of Council Grove were strong advocates. Opponents of any form of public acquisition of private land made establishment of the park questionable until the very end. Klataske says one reason the preserve is so important is that so little tallgrass prairie is left,
and the prairie contains a vast assortment of plants and animals.
Most prairies contain 250 to 300 different flowering plants and grasses. And then, of course, in association with all of this complex plant community, there are a far greater diversity of animals, invertebrates, insects, butterflies, birds, reptiles and amphibians and mammals. It's a truly remarkable landscape, and I think it's important to remember that it's a natural biome that once covered parts of 11 states in the central part of the country. At one point, most of Illinois, much of Iowa, and the eastern parts of Nebraska, the Dakotas, Kansas, and Oklahoma was covered by tallgrass prairie.
And now, how much is left?
Probably less than 3% of the tallgrass prairie remains today.
When I went to law school, my father taught me a rhyme about a lawyer that he had learned in law school 50 years earlier. It expressed the view often repeated today that lawyers are stiffs. The rhyme goes, "He looked across the flowering prairie and thought only of writs of certiorari." Now, with the establishment of the Tallgrass Prairie Preserve and Park in the Flint Hills of Kansas, lawyers in the next generation will get a chance to prove the poet was wrong. I'm Peter Burley. Our bodies are made of the same elements present in the earth. The water, minerals, and carbon which makes up the land and the sea is the same stuff which makes up each of us. So in a very real sense, the earth nourishes us, both physically and spiritually. Gary Ferguson is the author of Spirits of the Wild, the World's Great Nature Myths. He reads a story from Tangier, Morocco, called The Birth of the Almond Tree. For thousands of years, these trees have given people the gift of their seeds to eat.
What a blessing that through all of history there have been giving people, generous men and women with hearts as wide as the sky and brilliant as the sun. One among them was Princess Hatim, daughter of a sultan who lived a long time before there was even such a thing as the Land of Islam. Now, being the daughter of a sultan, Princess Hatim was, of course, wealthy beyond most people's grandest dreams. Yet not a single dirham did she keep, preferring instead to give her riches to the poor. Though some members of her family thought her foolish, they never interfered. It was her wealth, after all, and she could do with it as she wished. But great trouble arose the day her father found out that in addition to giving away her own fortune, she'd also been giving away his. Hatim had never mentioned this particular source of funding for her charities, nor did she show remorse when her father confronted her. "What would you suggest?" she asked, surprised that her father would be so upset. "Would you have me close my hand in the face of sickness and misery?" But her father saw the matter quite differently, as many no doubt would, and in the end he had to conclude that because his beloved Hatim had stolen from the royal family, she must be punished like any other. "You may choose death," he told her sadly, "or you may choose exile." After much anguish, Hatim told her father she would take death. How could she, after all, a daughter of the Maghrib, ever survive in a place far away from her beloved homeland? And so it was. But Allah was looking down from above that fateful day, granting favor to Hatim for having been so generous. He decided to turn her into an almond, perhaps the finest of all the trees. How appropriate. To this day, the almond tree continues to give gifts to the people, nuts and oil to help feed those who are hungry, and in spring, flowers so beautiful they bring joy to the troubled heart.
Gary Ferguson is the author of Spirits of the Wild, the World's Great Nature Myths. Thank you. A new tradition here at the Environment Show, until we think of another one, is to end each show with a song about the environment. This week, we hear from an artist who broke ground in 1971, and although he's no longer with us, his songs continue to inspire thought. Environment Show producer Stephanie Goichman reports.
Environmental issues weren't on the front burner in the early 70s, and they certainly weren't the subject of pop songs. But in 1971, Marvin Gaye released his groundbreaking record, What's Going On? Two songs reached number one, including Mercy, Mercy Me, which was the first song dealing with environmental issues to top the charts. It remains a classic.
Whoa, oh, mercy, mercy me. All things ain't what they used to be. No, no. Where did all the blue skies go? Poison is the wind that blows from the north and south and east. Whoa, mercy, mercy me. All things ain't what they used to be. No, no. Oil wasted on the oceans and upon high seas. Fish full of mercury. Oh, oh, mercy, mercy me. All things ain't what they used to be. No, no. Radiation underground and in the sky. Animals and birds who live nearby are alive. Oh, mercy, mercy me. All things and what they used to be. What about this overcrowded land? How much more we use from sand? Can't you from sand? Can't you stand?
Mercy Me by the late Marvin Gaye. In 1971, environmental issues took a back seat to protests against the Vietnam War, student uprisings, and the cultural revolutions of the day. But Gaye saw the natural world deteriorating and knew he had to speak out. David Ritz is the author of Divided Soul, The Life of Marvin Gaye. He says Gaye staked his career on his vision.
And when Mercy, Mercy Me was presented to the Motown management as a possible single release, I don't think everybody knew what ecology meant. They didn't want to put it out. They just thought it was too abstract and that, you know, Marvin was just out there and being too much of an idiosyncratic artist. And he told him if they didn't put it out, he would never record for Motown again. So he kind of had to use whatever leverage he had to demand the album's release. And it came out, it was a big hit, you know, it was like a number one hit across the board.
Ritz says Gaye's music had a tremendous effect on listeners, even though he didn't call for direct action. He says Gaye was pessimistic about the environment, and Mercy, Mercy Me expressed a simple sadness, which has resonated for over 25 years.
I kind of presume when I hear it that Marvin doesn't feel as though it's ever going to get turned around. You get the feeling of a kind of an inevitable deterioration. I don't know if you do when you hear it, but like, man, look what we're doing. We can't stop, and greed is taking over, and wow, it's sad. And ultimately, at the end of it, he turns to God, and he just kind of says, my sweet Lord, and almost that, you know, I have to turn my will over to you because there's really nothing I can do about this. Evil seems to be prevailing.
David Ritz is the author of Divided Soul, The Life of Marvin Gaye. If you have a song on the environment that has inspired you, let us know about it. Call us at 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. For The Environment Show, I'm Stephanie Goichman.
Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-888-49-GREEN and ask for show number 368. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Chartok is the executive producer. Thomas Lally is producer, and Stephanie Goichman is the associate producer. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Bullitt Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the Furthermore Division of the Kaplan Fund, and the Packard Foundation for coverage of fisheries issues. And Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-CAR-HERE. So long, and join us next week for The Environment Show.